remember, in our last episode, we explored Shakespeare's preoccupation with the animal kingdom, especially hedgehogs, and we discussed its implications in relation to dormice, squirrels, and ferrets.
And we introduced our new line of reduced Shakespeare Company action figures.
That's right, I'd forgotten about that.
Not available in stores.
Well, today we'll be exploring the comedy, Shakespeare's deliciously romantic and frolicking adventures, lighthearted, heartwarming, and simply hilarious.
I thought we'd decided that the comedies were the least funny plays ever written.
That was called sarcasm, Adam. It's very popular in Britain.
Oh.
Today we'll be exploring three key questions. Question number one.
Question number one.
Question number one. Are the comedies funny?
Are the comedies funny?
Are the comedies funny?
Reed?
No.
Adam?
No.
Austin?
No.
There you have it. The opinions are anonymous. But what plays are we actually talking about when we talk about Shakespeare's comedies?
Macbeth, Titus Andronicus,
no,
and Coriolanus.
No, Adam, those aren't the comedies. Those are the tragedies.
Yeah, but they're funny.
Well, irrespective and irregardless, Shakespeare's comedies are Love's Labour's Lost, The Comedy of Errors, Two Gentlemen of Verona, A Midsummer Night's Dream, Merchant of Venice, The Taming of the Shrew, The Merry Wives of Windsor, Much Ado About Nothing, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, All's Well That Ends Well, Measure for Measure, Pericles, Cymbeline, The Winter's Tale, and The Tempest.
It's audio footnote time!
Although Pericles, Cymbeline, The Winter's Tale, and The Tempest are sometimes classified as romances, we have accounted these plays among the comedies due to their uneven poetic value, unbelievable plot lines, shallow characterizations, and juvenile themes. They are among the Bard's greatest works.
That was audio footnote time!
Let's move on to the man himself, shall we?
Absolutely. Right now, let's play, just at random, a recording of As You Like It. Listen for the beauty of Shakespeare's poetic imagery. Has any other playwright so magically captured the language of love? I don't think so. See if you don't agree that these are some of the most beautiful lines ever written.
Here comes Orlando. How gently the dew of his words will settle on my bud to make it blossom all the more with the love that is duly his as his love is mine.
Mistress Minion, you wretched, puling young baggage.
Orlando, what means these words from your tongue?
My tongue and your tail, you impudent strumpet.
Why, thou jolt-head, illiterate horse and white-livered, wretched, bloody, usurping, malignant canker?
Well said. You're like a toad, ugly and venomous.
If mine eyes can wound, now let them kill thee!
You'll be rotten ere you be half-ripe.
By my troth, I was looking for a fool when I found you. I do desire that we may be better strangers!
Sell when you can, you are not for all markets!
Asshole!
That is so beautiful. That's so true. Excuse me. Let's go to question number two.
Question number two.
Question number two. What makes something funny?
What makes something funny?
What makes something funny?
Read.
Well, to answer that, let's take a look at the origin of the word comedy, from the Latin comae, referring to the straightening of one's hair.
I guess that's a verb that you don't have to use very often, huh, Reed?
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Comedy, Adam Long.
Thank you very much.
It's audio footnote time!
Adam has just demonstrated one of the first rules of comedy. When in doubt, make fun of the bald guy.
That was audio footnote time!
We should also notice the similarity between the verb comer and the verb come, meaning to move towards, but also a slang term for what the French call une petite mort, the little death. Comedy's very roots are found in death. That's why comedians are so afraid of dying on stage, why they want to go out and kill their audience.
Indeed, and the line between comedy and tragedy is very thin. For instance, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln was once considered tragic, but now it's considered one of the most hilarious moments in American history.
In fact, it was Abraham Lincoln who said, on his deathbed, "Dying is easy, comedy is hard," which echoes Socrates' remark, "On the whole, I'd rather be W.C. Fields," and of course, Henri Bergson's dictum that K's and Q's are consonants.
You know, my mother always told me, walk softly and carry a big dictum.
Too bad you didn't take her advice.
What do you mean?
I've seen you naked.
Oh, Mr. Comedy strikes again.
Hey, Adam, come over here and say that.
No.
Yes.
Every time I step away from the microphone, you hit me, Reed. I'm not doing it.
Okay, this time I won't.
I don't believe you.
I won't, really. I promise.
Okay.
Okay, good. Come here.
Ow!
It's audio footnote time!
Reed has just demonstrated a second rule of comedy. The physical pain of others is invariably funny, unless, of course, it goes too far.
That was audio footnote time!
Well, I didn't think it was funny.
I sure did, Reed.
Side-splittingly so.
Just how far can one go? I mean, at what point does another's pain cease to be funny? Let's do a little on-air experiment here. Let's push the sides of the comedy envelope, if you will. Adam, if you would act as the subject of the experiment...
Oh, no,
and,
I don't
and,
think
and
so.
And Reed, if you would pull Adam's hair...
Right.
No! Ow!
Now, that's funny.
Oh, definitely,
Reed?
Yeah. Definitely.
Oh, I know. Hey, try stomping on his foot.
No!
Okay.
Ow!
That's hilarious, Reed. What do you think?
Oh, definitely. Now Adam knows what it's like to be an Olympic athlete.
Well, how do you mean?
He knows the agony of defeat.
Oh!
It's audio footnote time.
That was an excellent example of comedy that borders on the tragic. As we've learned, pain can be very funny, but also, very often humor itself causes pain. Audiences often groan at particularly lame punchlines, but they also groan, justifiably, in anticipation of more comedy clunkers to come. This feeling is known as foreboding.
That was Audio for No Time!
Well, so far so good with the pain comedy theory. Let's really go for it this time.
Yeah.
Reed, do you have that frying pan heated up?
10-4, good buddy.
Great, all right. Okay, to see how far we can go, let's not only put Adam into the frying pan.
What?
Hold him down, Reed.
Yeah,
hold
yeah,
him. Yeah, okay, good. Ow. To see how far we can go, let's not only put Adam into the frying pan, but also this cute little kitty cat. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, comic history in the making right here on the Reduced Shakespeare Radio Show. You are so cute. Now, if this gets a laugh, we'll be oh, shoot. Well, hang on. Reduced Shakespeare Radio Show.
Hello, you guys are really sick.
How's that, caller?
If you dare harm that pretty little kitty cat, I'm gonna call the Humane Society.
So, you feel we've gone too far?
Definitely.
Well, how about if we let the cat go, but we fry Adam?
Oh, well, yeah, that'd be okay.
No! Ow!
The BBC would like to apologize for the previous segment, which went horribly, horribly wrong. We'd like to take this opportunity to absolve ourselves of responsibility for the scene and point out that it was the fault of, well, somebody else. We now return you to the Reduced Shakespeare Radio Show.
In the studio today, we have a special guest who will be joining us in a spirited discussion about the Merry Wives of Windsor. And who better than one of the Merry Wives of Windsor herself? Ladies and gentlemen, please give a nice, round, warm, Reduced Shakespeare Company welcome to the beautiful Princess Di! Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here with us.
My pleasure.
Tell us, Di, what are the Merry Husbands of Windsor up to at the moment?
Well, with the royal family being privatized, we all have to do our part. So Charles is giving polo lessons, Andy's training to do foot massage, and Edward's performing the Chippendales.
Wow, they all had to take day jobs?
Mm-hmm.
Man, I guess the Queen was right. It really was an annus horribilis, wasn't it?
You got that straight.
Can you give us any insight as to why Fergie behaves in the often erratic way she does?
Uh-huh. Cannabis horribilis.
Really?
Ooh. Yeah, she tried therapy for a while to try and straighten herself out, but it didn't work.
Oh, analyst horribilis?
Bingo. It's not easy being a member of the mediocrity.
No, it's not. But, so Di, all things considered, I guess that being a wife of Windsor isn't so merry after all.
Yeah, that's an accurate assessment.
Now, Di, maybe we better talk about Shakespeare's comedies a little bit.
Sorry, I don't know anything about him. I've never even met the man.
He's been dead for over 400 years.
I didn't even know he was sick.
You don't know anything about Shakespeare's comedies?
Mm-mm.
You're kind of worthless as a guest then, aren't you?
A panelist horribilis,
uh-huh.
Really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, one thing that might be interesting to our listeners, though, is that you look completely different in person than you do on television.
Yes, that is true.
Could you describe yourself for the people at home?
Mm-hmm. I'm wearing a tasteful print skirt, lit from behind, of course, carrying a Chanel handbag, I've got a hairy chest, I'm 6'2", and I am completely bald.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, and that's because Princess Di is not actually Princess Di, but our own Reed Martin, professional impressionist.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I thought something was weird.
Well, Reed, you fooled us all yet again.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to say it's a gift.
Why don't we just listen to some of the recorded excerpts we prepared? Now, these are mostly contemporary interpretations of the comedies, and we can start with some Peter Brook. By way of introduction, I should explain that Peter Brook is an English director who now lives in Paris, and perhaps his most infamous interpretation was his French production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which took place on trapeze and trampolines. Here is an excerpt from that production recorded in Paris.
Look, Lysander, there is the fair Helena.
Oh, and look, Demetrius, what the fairies have brought me. They have given me Hermia.
Ho, ho, then you will need an operation.
Ho, 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 ho.
Thank heaven for little girls.
Zut alors, look, it is Theseus, Duke of Athens.
Bonjour, I am heading back to court in my carriage. May I offer you a lift?
Oui, oui.
Not in my carriage, you don't.
At last those pesky humans have left the forest. Titania, I am so glad to have you back.
Oh, Oberon, that will teach you to take me for granted. Now, take me to my leafy bower.
Oui, oui.
Not in my leafy bower, you don't.
Oh, my Titania, there is only one thing funnier than the oui, oui joke.
What is that, my love?
The ever-popular fart joke!
Oh, man.
Why does he do that?
He had to ruin it.
He's so disgusting. He does it all the time.
He thinks it's funny, Austin. That's why. I find it extremely distasteful.
What is it about... Well, you know, though, I mean, it does seem to connect with an audience on some visceral level, you
what
know
What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, whether people laugh at a fart joke or despise it, it clearly elicits a genuine emotional response. I mean, we have to face the facts.
Yeah, I guess what you're saying is there's a primal quality to it.
Exactly. You know, perhaps it taps into some deep-seated modern neurosis linked to, I don't know, denial of the body and its life-supporting functions. That could be it.
But is the audience response caused by the sound itself or speculation about the mentality of a person who would make such a sound?
That's a good
and
point.
And consider it entertaining.
That's a very good point. Of course, you're right. You know, the farteur is unwittingly becoming a pathetic character and therefore touching the listener, the fartee, if you will,
exactly.
Right, on a very deep level.
This is starting to piss me off.
On the other hand, it is very annoying.
I know. I hate him.
Well,
shut up!
And that, of course, was Bottom the Weaver's famous death speech as performed by Marcel Marceau.
Very moving.
Only moving. Perhaps the most controversial of Shakespeare's comedies is Merchant of Venice, particularly upsetting to the Jewish community because of Shakespeare's portrayal of Shylock's daughter Jessica, a nice girl who upsets her father by marrying out.
The definitive, cutting-edge production of Merchant was staged by Martin Scorsese at the New York Shakespeare Festival in 1973. Here now is an audio recording of the famous courtroom scene from Merchant of Venice, which bears the unmistakable stamp of the young Scorsese.
Come in.
Order into court. Order into court. The courtroom will come to order.
All right already with the gavel already. Shut up!
Shylock, are you determined to take Bassanio's pound of flesh already?
Hey, I only want what's owed to me, Your Honor, all right? Bassanio owes me 3 bills he didn't pay up. Bada boom, bada bing, I'm going to take a pound of his flesh.
Excuse me, Your Honor, but as Bassanio's lawyer, I'm saying that Shylock can have his pound of flesh.
What, are you nuts?
Hey, you're all right, you know that? You're a mensch.
I'm not a mensch. Look.
I'm Portia in disguise.
Whoa! Portia, doll! I should have given you a bigger portion, you know what I mean? Bada boom, bada bing.
Watch it, Shylock. Do you know the length of the penal laws in this state?
What, are you going to hit me with a subpoena?
You got no idea about the size of my subpoenas.
Your Honor, I object to that remark on the grounds that it's a cheap joke. All I'm saying is that Shylock can have his pound of flesh.
You bet your asbestos I can have my pound of flesh.
But if you spill one drop of blood or take one extra ounce of flesh, you forfeit your claim and you'll be put to death.
Get out of here.
I'm serious, Shylock. You claimed 1 pound of flesh only, so that's all you can have.
What, are you nuts? I want my pound of flesh.
Hey, this here's your pound of flesh.
Hey, put that away, Bassanio. What are you, nuts?
No, these are my nuts.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry I asked.
Look, my contract said I get a pound of flesh.
Yeah, but that's all you get. No blood, no muscle, no nothing.
Get out of here.
That's the law.
The law? You're trying to explain to me? You're talking to me? You're talking to me? I'll tell you what the law is, sister. This here's the law in New York City.
Are you ready to hear your sentence, Shylock?
Yeah, whatever.
For the crime of discharging an automatic weapon with intent to kill in a government building, I hereby give you the maximum sentence allowed in an American court, 6 months probation. But for the crime of that accent, I hereby give you a sentence of 10 years, 3 predicates, and a dangling modifier. This court is adjourned.
Truly, this same wit was the inspiration for Oscar Wilde and Noel Coward.
You know, Shakespeare's timelessness is amazing, and did you know he actually visited New York City? And Shakespeare's relationship with the U.S. of A. didn't end with his trip to the Big Apple. It stretches all the way to Memphis, Tennessee, and a young man named Elvis Aaron Presley. Here's a song from Much Ado About Nothing, which the King recorded in 1961. It soared to number 167 on the charts, just behind Pat Boone's rendition of Why Don't We Do It in the Road. Here it is now, for your listening pleasure, a rare recording of Elvis singing Shakespeare's Sigh No More, Ladies, Sigh No More.
Sigh no more, ladies, sigh no more. Men were deceivers ever. One foot at sea and one on shore. To one thing constant ever. and sigh not sober, let them go and be you blithe and balmy, converting all your songs of woe to hey, naughty, naughty.
Elvis, you're big, you're freaking huge,
he's enormous.
Sing no more, diddle, sing no more, a lump so dull and heavy. The proud of man was ever so, since summer bird was levy. And sigh not sober, let them go, and be you blithe and mommy. Converting all your songs of woe to hey, naughty, naughty. Converting all your songs of woe to hey, naughty, naughty. Converting all your songs of woe to hey, naughty, naughty. How's that, Colonel? Give me some fries, a big orange drink.
Elvis Presley with an excerpt from Much Ado About Nothing. You know, that's my favorite Shakespeare comedy.
Well, my favorite comedy is the one with the shipwreck.
That's Twelfth Night.
No. Twelfth Night is the one with the twins.
No, read, Comedy of Errors has the twins.
No, it has two sets of twins, actually.
Well, Comedy of Errors has two sets of twins, but in Twelfth Night, there's one set of twins, a shipwreck, and a woman disguised as a man.
Wait.
I thought As You Like It had a woman disguised
as
a man. But he said that Twelfth Night was the one with a woman disguised as a man.
Oh, well, it does, too. But Twelfth Night is set in Illyria and has twins and a shipwreck, and As You Like It has a duke's evil usurping brother and is set in a forest.
Yeah, but Measure for Measure is about an evil usurping brother. Merchant of Venice has a woman disguised as a man, and Midsummer Night's Dream is set in a forest.
Oh, yeah, but Midsummer Night's Dream is the one that's got magic spells in it, right?
The Tempest is the one with magic spells, and that's the one I was talking about.
What one?
The one with the shipwreck.
Oh, but what about All's Well That Ends Well and A Winter's Tale?
Well, All's Well's the one where a guy sleeps with a woman by mistake. And in Winter's Tale, the king's wife isn't really dead. She's just been pretending to be a statue for 14 years.
Oh, that's right.
You see, this is what I've always said, man. The problem with Shakespeare's comedies is that they're just like 70s rock bands, man. They're all the same.
70s rock bands?
Exactly.
I hate 70s rock bands.
Well, so go stand in a corner then.
Why?
Reed?
I'm going.
Good.
So, Austin, who's your favorite band from the 70s?
Yes.
Who?
Yes.
Really?
Sure. Well, they had the best keyboard player of all time.
No, they didn't. They never even had a keyboard player.
What?
They never had a keyboard player.
Who never had a keyboard player?
Yes.
Who?
Yes, not even after they lost what's-his-name, the drummer.
The what?
No, the who, the drummer. What was his name?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Moon.
What?
Moon.
All right, fine.
What are you doing?
You said Moon.
No, Moon the drummer.
Well, Reed's not a drummer, he's an accordion player.
Hey, leave me out of this.
Pull up your pants, man.
Fine, all right, all right.
All right, forget about that. Guess who's my favorite band from the 70s?
I have no idea.
No, guess who's my favorite band from the 70s?
I told you, I have no idea.
Listen to me, Austin. Guess who's my favorite band
from the 70s? I don't know, I can't
I'm
guess.
I'm telling you, guess who's my favorite
and
band
I'm
from the 70s?
I'm telling you, I don't know the band!
Oh, they're good too.
Who?
The band.
The who?
No, not the who, the band.
What band?
The band!
All right, I'll guess. The band was America.
No, Canadian, except for the drummer.
Don't start with me again about the drummers.
The band was Canadian, they backed up Dylan.
A Canadian band backed up a Welsh poet?
No, I thought you were an expert on music.
Well, I am. I mean, I don't know every single obscure band that played for literary figures. No, but I am an expert.
Oh, you mean X being an unknown quantity and spurt being a drip under pressure.
Well, exactly. Wait a second. Well, forget about that. What about you? Have you ever been to a rock concert?
Of course I have.
Where? Who'd you see?
Boston.
Where?
Chicago.
What?
Chicago.
You just said Boston.
No, that's right, Boston.
Well, what about Chicago?
Well, I love Chicago, but then I was only 17.
Well, really? Well, where'd you see him? Oh, I know. Boston, Chicago. Yeah.
Now listen closely, Austin. It's very simple. The Who's my favorite band, the band backed Dylan, and Chicago wrote 25 or 6 to 4.
Well, which one was it?
What?
25 or 6 to 4?
That's what Chicago wrote.
That's what I'm trying to find out.
That's what I'm telling you.
25 or 6 to 4?
That's right.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
But I also like some of the new bands. You too?
Yeah, of course. I like some of the new bands.
You too?
I just said I did.
You too.
What is the matter with you?
The band's name is U2.
Well, now you tell me. And they're Canadian, right?
No, they're Irish, and their lead singer is Bono.
Well, why didn't you say so? Of course, I know who Bono is.
Good, finally.
I don't like him.
Why not?
Well, I think he should have stayed married to Cher.
Oh, well, Cher's okay, but I like K.D. Lang better.
K.D. Lang?
Precisely.
Well, now you're talking about women disguised as men.
Isn't that Twelfth Night?
I don't know.
Third base. On that note, let us return to our discussion of the comedies, or, as I guess we're beginning to understand them, the controversies.
What we have discovered is that Shakespeare used the same plot devices repeatedly in his comedies.
You see, essentially, Shakespeare was a formula writer. Once he found a device that worked, he used it
over and over and over again.
So, Mr. Shakespeare, the question we have is this.
Why did you write 16 comedies when you could have written just one?
Well, in answer to this question, we've taken the liberty of condensing all 16 of Shakespeare's comedies into a single epic, which we have entitled The Comedy of Two Well-Measured Gentlemen Lost in the Merry Wives of Venice on a Midsummer's Twelfth Night in Winter.
Or Cymbeline Taming Pericles the Merchant in The Tempest of Love as Much as You Like It for Nothing. Act 1. A Spanish duke swears an oath of celibacy and turns the rule of the city over to his sadistic and tyrannical twin brother. He learns some fantastical feats of magic and sets sail for the Golden Age of Greece along with his daughters, three beautiful and virginal sets of identical twins.
Hi!
While rounding the hill of Italy, the duke's ship is caught in a terrible tempest, which in its fury casts the duke upon a desert island along with the loveliest and most virginal of his daughters, who stumbles into a cave where she is molested by a creature who is either a man or a fish or both.
Ew, get away, you slimy, horrible animal!
I am not an animal, I am a fish!
Ew, I hate seafood!
Act 2. The long-lost sons of the Duke's brother, also coincidentally three sets of identical twins, have just arrived in Italy.
Hi.
Though still possessed of an inner nobility, they are ragged, destitute, penniless, flea-infested shadows of the men they once were, and, in the utmost extremity, are forced to borrow money from an old Jew, who deceives them into putting down their brains as collateral on the loan. Now, the six brothers fall in love with six Italian sisters, three of whom are contentious, sharp-tongued little shrews.
Henry, carry my bags!
Yes, dear.
While the other three are submissive, airheaded little bimbos.
Act 3. The shipwrecked, identical daughters of the Duke wash up on the shores of Italy, disguise themselves as men, become pages to the shrews and matchmakers to the Duke's brother's sons.
Hi!
They lead the lovers into the forest, where, on a midsummer's night, a bunch of mischievous fairies squeeze the aphroditic juice of a hermaphroditic flower into the shrew's eyes, causing them to fall in love with their own pages, who in turn have fallen in love with the Duke's brother's sons, while the queen of the fairies seduces a jackass, and they all have a lovely, bisexual, animalistic orgy.
Act 4.
The elderly fathers of the Italian sisters, finding their daughters missing, dispatch messages to the pages telling them to kill every man in the vicinity.
However, unable to find men in the forest, the faithful messengers, in a final misguided act of loyalty, deliver the messages to each other and kill themselves.
Meanwhile, the fish creature and the Duke arrive in the forest disguised as Russians, and for no apparent reason perform a two-man underwater version of Uncle Vanya.
Are you Uncle Vanya?
I am.
Ouch!
Act 5.
The Duke commands the fairies to right their wrongs.
The pages and the bimbos get into a knockdown, drag-out fight in the mud.
During which the pages' clothes get ripped off, revealing female genitalia.
The Duke recognizes his daughters.
Ew. The Duke's brother's sons recognize their uncle.
One of the shrews marries the governor of Arkansas and becomes First Lady of the United States.
And in the end, everyone gets married and goes out to dinner.
Except for a minor character in the second act who gets eaten by a bear, and the Duke's brother's sons, who, unable to pay back the old Jew, give themselves lobotomies.
And they all live happily ever after.
Well, boys and girls, you all know what that bell means. It means we're just about out of time. What have we learned today?
I learned that it's better to give than to receive.
I learned that the greatest band of the 70s was Abbott and Costello.
And I learned that those who can't teach go into restaurant management.
Right on.
Well, that's it for today. Let's wrap it up.
Rap!
Hey,
somebody
said rap! Let's hit it!
O-T-T, how can I tell it?
Not too hard to spell it. So listen up and soon you get to yell it.
O is for over.
T is for thee.
The last T, well, that's where we take ye. You see, we found a way to satisfy your craving when you're bored of the bard of Stratford-upon-Avon.
We think old Bill's too stuffy.
He needs to loosen, so we take his boring plays and we reduce
them.
The poetry, the subplots, the imagery that's illin', and we get right to the sex and to the killing.
We dress up in tights and walk the doublet walk. We hold forth, soliloquize, talk iambic talk. And like a mama with a great big bottle, we'll be yards. We're in charge and we ain't too subtle. No magic, no secret, damn, there ain't no voodoo. We tell lots of dick jokes, jokes about doo-doo.
When that don't work and the audience is bugging, we ain't too proud, we'll act stupid, start mugging.
And just to make sure we never ever flop,
We do it all right over the top. We take it OTT.
D-R-S-C.
We take it OTT.
D-R-S-C.
We take it OTT.
D-R-S-C.
Say, who are we?
D-R-S-C.
That's us. We're the Redo Shakespeare Company. And we don't swallow, but we follow this recipe. Bill's old-fashioned, out of style, like an Edsel. Treated like a god, you know, up on a pedestal.
We yank him off and tell the world, yo, later. Little Billy's little better than a bear baiter.
He's a poet, we know it, yo. There's nothing plainer, but above all that, the man was an entertainer, and yo, listen up, here's the nub of my gist. That Shakespeare dude was a wicked plagiarist.
He sold everything he did like rappers he would sample, and we ain't stupid, so we follow his example.
We look to the past to be our inspirator. We look beyond the fringe to the fireside theater.
Likes the goons,
the pythons,
stooges,
the brothers Marx. We gobble up influences like we are hungry sharks. We're not afraid to be musical vultures. We're three white boys ripping off black culture. We'll say it, we'll rap it, whatever it takes to give Bill Shakespeare back the shakes. We take it OTT.
D-R-S-C.
We take it OTT.
D-R-S-C.
We take it OTT.
D-R-S-C.
Say, who are we?
D-R-S-C.
Now, you can go OTT too if you wanna,
but do it with taste, restraint, not like Madonna, cause nobody cares if you give it all away.
What you gotta do is remember to play.
Hey! Nothing is sacred, so kick up a fuss. Make fun of everything, including each one of us. Baldy!
Egghead!
Man-child, don't fake it! Cause if you dish it out, you know you got to take it.
That's the only way to go if you got to juice.
You can take on the world if you wanna reduce.
Well, it's Shakespeare now, but what's coming up new?
Well, U.S. history,
the Bible too.
We hip-hop, flip-flop, all over the tip-top. All over the world, people laugh as we slip-slop.
We don't wanna brag, but we take the prize by cutting huge things right down to size.
And that's the way we do it if you got to know.
So jump back out the way, here we come, here we go. Introduce us, gooses, excuses gotta stop. Reduce it down to size, take it over the top. We take it OTT,
B-R-S-C.
We take it OTT,
B-R-S-C.
We take it OTT,
B-R-S-C.
Say, who are we?
B-R-S-C.
We take it OTT,
E-R-S-C.
We take it OTT,
E-R-S-C.
We take it OTT,
E-R-S-C.
Say, who are we?
E-R-S-C.
To be or not to be, that is the question. To be or not to be, that is the question.
A horse, a horse, a horse.
Shall I compare thee?
Ladies and gentlemen, in this episode, we have been forced to omit our sound effect of the week. For this, we apologize. The sound effect was to have been a cat frying. In lieu of the regularly scheduled sound effect, we now present an alternate sound effect for your listening pleasure.
The Reduced Shakespeare Radio Show was written and performed by Adam Long, Reed Martin, and Austin Titch.